Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm Janet Hutchings, EQMM's editor. This month we feature the work of G.M. Mallier, a writer who broke onto the mystery scene in 2008 with Death of a Cozy Writer, a novel that won an Agatha Award for Best Novel and was picked by Kirkus Reviews as a Best Book of the Year. An American raised in a military family, the author has lived in many places throughout the world, but for her fiction, she almost always chooses a British setting. She's authored nearly a dozen well-received novels over the decade since her debut, and she also writes short stories for EQMM and other venues. We recorded this podcast at the Malice Domestic Convention in Bethesda, Maryland in April of this year. Here is G.M. Mallier reading her story, The Oxford Tarts, from the March-April 2017 issue of EQMM.
There's a letter in your pigeonhole, Dr. Grantling. It was just handed me by a young lady. Did I imagine it, or did the voice of the porter of St. James's College convey a certain frost at the mention of the young lady? One could so easily misread the nuances in a porter's manner. Judging by the degree of frost, the young lady was likely one of those now admitted to degrees of Oxford University, a development that still had some of the dons clutching their hearts in apoplexy at the very idea that it took so long for women to earn full acceptance when they had in every way excelled academically, made their achievement and their patience the more remarkable. For some long years, they could only attend lectures if they were given by a family member. Why it was thought lectures by a brother or uncle were more interesting and less corrupting than others, or why young ladies would be more susceptible than young men to an hysterical reaction to new ideas, is anyone's guess. In the year 1925, surely mankind had progressed beyond superstition and misogyny. But as an American, a visiting professor from Harvard, I thought it best to keep a low profile and do as the Romans, or at least to wear the toga, try to blend in, and softly, softly make my case for equality. A biography I happened to be reading of John Greenleaf Whittier inspired me to want to level the playing field for all of God's children, male and female. I thought I knew who might have authored the eyebrow-lifting missive, and on opening the envelope I saw I was right. It may have been delivered by a young woman, but its contents were written by a woman of mature years, one Lady Felicia Barker, an acknowledged expert in ancient Greek and Latin languages. I admired her as much for her knowledge as for what she had overcome to make her way in a world designed for the comfort of men. On tearing open the envelope, I could not suppress a small gasp of bewilderment, which fortunately caught the porter's attention. The letterhead identified it as being from St. Helena's house, the coat of arms prominently displayed, Vert, three unicorns rampant. The page held only a few words written in black ink in an elegant script, such as might be seen in an ancient church ledger. I read, "Please come at once. I have an urgent and confidential matter to discuss with you. I rely utterly on your haste and discretion. Signed, Felicia Barker." "Not bad news, I hope, Dr. Grantling," said the porter, of course hoping that it was so he could spread the word. "No, no," I said, tucking the missive inside an inner pocket of my coat. "The seamstress with whom I left my best shirt to be mended has met with a delay, that is all. Most distressing." I stopped to wonder at how easily the lie fell from my lips. But I had never trusted the porter, and furthermore, I suspected he was overfond of the demon rum. I wondered why the college kept him in such a position of trust, as in addition to barring entry to those he deemed unsuitable, he had access to everyone's rooms and any secrets they might hold. Most porters were former police officers or soldiers, and of a sterling character. Not the case, I thought, with the porter of St. James's College. "I see," he said, clearly not believing me. "He may be a rogue, but he is no fool. Will you be dining in hall tonight, sir?" "Do you know, I believe I'll be dining out. Thank you for reminding me. If you would convey my planned absence to the kitchen staff in time, there's a good man." "Very well, Dr. Grantling." Again, I could almost see the frost forming at the edge of his words as they floated in the air. Perhaps this was not the done thing, to send word to the kitchen via the porter. I always seemed to be putting a foot wrong. By dining out, I meant to stop into the turf for a pint and a mince pie. Since I had no idea what Lady Felicia wanted of me, I didn't want to tie myself to a timetable and have to hurry back. Meals at the high table were a bit of an ordeal at the best of times anyway. You try holding a conversation with an ancient German polymath who is hugely opinionated and nearly deaf, and you'll see what I mean. I exited one of the large oak doors of the college, which stood open onto Turl Street, admitting a mild autumn breeze. Fall had been delayed by an unusually warm summer, but the days were chilly now as evening came on, and I had wrapped around my neck a scarf in the colors of the college. Turning right outside the porter's lodge, I made my way toward St. Helena's house. It may be as well to insert here a brief history of the house and Lady Felicia's role in its sterling reputation, as well as how I came to know her. The house was established just after the founding of Lady Margaret Hall in 1879. It sits along the River Charwell amidst vast tended grounds, including a sunken garden, that make it the envy of other colleges at the city center. Its founding principal was the redoubtable Agnes Raine Montague, who lived just long enough to complete her seventh well-received novel and, her health collapsing, passed the baton to Lady Felicia. The house had since trebled in size from the original 12 members to 36. There were many who resented the very existence of this college, many like the porter who felt a woman's place was in the home, making his supper. It had at one time been the scene of some nonviolent protests without its gates, and the subject of many an outraged editorial in the Times, but it had prevailed, to be followed by several other all-female institutions founded by broader-minded men and women. I could not think, as I approached the red brick buildings with their white stone facings, what could have induced Lady Felicia to call on me. If ever there were a lady capable of handling any event short of the apocalypse, it was she. Every college had a physician on call, as a matter of course, but I wondered if she sought confirmation of some dire medical diagnosis and prayed that would not be the case. She was not, after all, a young woman. I made myself known at the porter's lodge, here a friendly young woman, during the day the students took it in turn to mind the gate, and waited for a suitable escort to take me to Lady Felicia's rooms, for obviously a lone male could not be seen to wander the grounds alone. In due course, another young lady appeared, this one forbidding in appearance, and having introduced herself as Miss Rooley, she led me past buildings of French Renaissance design to the offices in the central block from which Lady Felicia held sway. This block, I knew, also contained the hall and the library, while the accommodations for students and tutors were situated at a further and presumably safer remove behind a thick screen of trees. Lady Felicia was the daughter of a man who had been one of my own professors long ago when I had come to Oxford to do advanced research in tropical diseases of the blood, which topic happened to be my specialty. Professor Barker had taken an interest in a lonely, displaced American, and he and his wife had often invited me to their home for dinner. I don't think they were aware, or perhaps they were, that these occasions were often the only times I had a full and appetizing meal during my time in Oxford, the meals in college for graduate students being neither inexpensive nor satisfying. It was then, of course, that I met Lady Felicia. At the time, she was perhaps 40 to my 22 years, and of such formidable intellect, I quickly gave up trying to find a topic of mutual interest and simply let her seize the reins of the conversation. I learned more about the Greeks and Romans than I have since forgotten, but when she later took over the college which she had had such a hand in nourishing, I became her staunchest supporter. It was this, I think, more than my qualities as a good listener at table, that seemed to endear me to her. Finding men to support the cause of equal treatment for women was, as she herself put it, like looking for a trout in a desert. Never married, she spent most of her days in the Ashmolean, or so I imagined, happily examining its collections of artifacts. We greeted each other as the old friends we were, and she motioned me to a chair in front of her desk, she'd taken the chair beside mine. I took this rightly as a sign that this conversation was confidential in nature rather than official. otherwise she would have stayed seated in her usual position of authority. First ensuring that Miss Ruley had well and truly, if reluctantly and scowlingly, left us alone, she came right to the point. I regret to tell you that I believe there has been a poisoning in Hall. I had expected there might be an effort to topple the house, or rather its good reputation, but never this. Most of the detractors of St. Helena's house confined themselves to writing scurrilous letters to the Times. Catching some of her urgency, I said, "Tell me all, and tell me in the order it happened." I knew I could rely on her trained scholar's mind to present the facts without embellishment and with few detours. Note that I did not immediately protest that this was a matter for the police. I knew full well why she did not want the authorities involved, except as a last resort. A scandal while the college was still in its infancy would be disastrous. She gave me a weak smile. She had the look about her that I have come to equate with the great scholars, a sort of disheveled but timeless look, as of one whose mind was likely to stray from small matters like food and sleep in order to focus on the broader issues. Her graying hair was pulled into a top knot above her handsome face, and at her neck was a cameo brooch I recognized as having once belonged to her mother. "I knew you would understand right away," she said. "Here is what has happened. Last night we held a formal hall to honor our first principal. At the end of the meal, one of our first-year students stood up and ran from the room. I thought not much of it. It may happen. A sudden sickness, an aversion to some ingredient in the food, an unsuspected allergy. I do find that young people, when they fall ill, do so more intensely than do the elderly, don't you? Anyway, the rest of us resumed eating our meal." I nodded, picturing the fine oak paneling of the hall gleaming in the candlelit dusk, gowns rustling, the murmur of voices declaiming on their particular topic, the occasional refined bray of laughter. Wine glasses in silver also would shine, although the rules of the college forbade the consumption of wine by the undergraduates. I had been a guest one night at high table, an honor accorded to very few of my sex. It had been an excellent meal, far exceeding what I'd become accustomed to at St. James's. And then another of our scholars took ill. The rest, noticing what was happening, put down their forks, growing alarmed. A few more claimed to feel ill, but by that time I think it was the power of suggestion. "And what was on the menu that night?" "I knew you would ask, so I wrote out the menu for you." She handed me a piece of paper from her desk. "A fine standing roast, carved in the kitchen before being carried out to the table. Potatoes and mixed vegetables served in the family style. That is, bowls of these side dishes were passed around. Bread and water and wine were appropriate. Nothing out of the usual, except perhaps of a finer quality, since it was a celebration meal. And to finish, for pudding we had individual baked berry tarts, topped with thick cream. I assume the doctor was called in. What was his opinion?" "His opinion," and here she lowered her voice as if we might be overheard through the thick paneled walls, "the opinion of Dr. Watts is that it was poison, likely administered via the tarts. Everyone was fine, you see, until we arrived at the final course of the leisurely meal. He did an analysis in his private laboratory of one of the tarts, but the results were inconclusive. Traces of a substance arsenical in nature, but not arsenic. I hardly know what he means by that. Have you saved a sample of any of the remaining pastries?" "Oh, yes. I had the cook set aside 5 of them that had been served but not consumed. As I say, once the women came to understand something was wrong, they stopped eating. And some of them are always on a slimming regime, and so either refuse the pudding or simply play with it when it is served, a wasteful practice I've tried to eradicate. Of those who consumed the tarts, were all taken ill?" "Mostly, yes, but in varying degrees. Some were quite deathly ill for most of the night. Some had just a touch of stomach upset. And some, as I have said, may have been persuaded they were ill, but were not in reality. We attract young people of the highest mental caliber. But such keen intelligence often goes with a high level of impressionability. Don't you find that to be true? Might I see the 5 remaining pies? Yes, I thought you might want to. We shall have to visit the kitchen so you can examine them. I've ordered them put under lock and key. And what is your theory, Lady Felicia? I was certain she had one. I suspect sabotage, of course. We are an unpopular presence here at Oxford, as I'm sure you are aware. When it was being decided to admit women to degrees of the university, it was thought to be a scandal and a disgrace among those of hobgoblin minds that we have survived and are beginning to thrive. That, to some, is unthinkable, unbearable. A scandal is what they predicted, and a scandal is what this news will cause if it gets out, which it is almost certain to do. The best we can hope for is that there is an explanation less sinister than one of deliberate poisoning carried out by a member of our staff. You are certain it was done by a member of your staff? She hesitated. It doesn't seem possible, but yes. The pastries were prepared and baked on site. We have only a cook and her assistant. I've known the cook since she came here 4 years ago. Her assistant is new. Sadly, the interpretation of these facts leads one to conclude. She let the sentence hang in the air. It is not possible one of your scholars is involved. She bridled. That is highly unlikely. They were not involved in the food preparation, and the pastries were individual ones, mind, and more than one woman was taken ill. In other words, no one person was targeted. And it is inconceivable a poisoner would risk harming so many in the pursuit of one person only, unless we were dealing with an utter madwoman, and I like to think we would have spotted a madwoman in our midst. But to answer your question, 2 of the newer members of the college helped serve. They work on a rotating schedule. Service to others is character building, and thus no one is excused. All was as usual. Are these servers notified well in advance of their duties? She did not want to reply, but grudgingly she said, yes, they are women of the highest caliber, and from 2 of the finest families in the land. Let us go and talk with your cook and her assistant, I said. The kitchen of St. Helena's was separated from the hall by a covered archway, a design intended to make serving easier while keeping the smells, noises, and hazards of cooking away from the diners. Just as we reached the door to the kitchen, I gestured Lady Felicia to one side. Can you vouch absolutely for the kitchen staff, without hesitation? Yes, I hired both of them myself, and they came with excellent references. Mary the cook is a widow from the same village where I grew up. Her husband's family is well known in the area, and of an unimpeachable character. She needed employment when he died, and she was referred to us by Lord Bandrich himself. And the kitchen maid, her assistant? Alice is vouched for by the cook, actually, although Alice is from London. She was not known to me personally, but she is a niece of Mary's. I have no qualms as to her character. She keeps herself to herself, and Mary seems, if not pleased by her work, then willing to work with her to improve her work. She came to us inexperienced, but eager to learn. Another pause as she added, she is perhaps not the brightest of girls, but I remind myself she has not had the advantages of my young scholars either. And no doubt her wages were low, always a consideration for any domestic bursar trying to balance a college's budget. This thought I kept to myself as we entered the kitchen. As one, the 2 kitchen workers stopped what they were doing and dropped a curtsy amidst a swirl of flour dust. They both looked nervous and no doubt could guess the reason for our visit. The older woman, Mary, was remarkable for the plainness of her attire, as befitting her widowed state. Everything she wore was black, and what was not black, her apron and the cap she wore pinned to her head, was bleached white and spotless. Beneath the cap was a line of gray hair above a pleasing, plump countenance. She was possibly 50 years of age. Her assistant was younger, and her manner of dress was of a marked contrast. She wore a kaleidoscope of colors, a red patterned dress with a green overskirt, a brown scarf with a red and yellow design protected her hair from the flour. I wondered that the cook had not tried to rein in these sartorial choices, but concluded that the girl was presentable enough when she put on the traditional servant's white outer garment to clear the tables. She was pretty in the way all young women of that age are pretty, an example of the English rose in her complexion, blue eyes, and fair hair beneath the gaudy scarf. I asked to see the five offending pastries, and the principal produced a set of keys. She walked over to what I took to be a pie safe, in this case literally a safe, because it had a small lock on its closing hasp. She opened the doors and stepped back. They three stood looking at me expectantly, so I said, "There's nothing for it but to cut open each pie for a visual inspection. We shall save them, however, should Dr. Watts want to examine each one. There is no such thing as an undetectable poison, you know, and we are fortunate to have such a large number of samples for him to experiment on." Mary produced a knife and proceeded to cut each pie in half. I asked for a fork and began to poke about the contents. "Might I have a large bowl of water and some manner of strainer? A slotted spoon will do." I used the fork to scoop out some of the filling in one pie and rinse it in the water. Then I used the slotted spoon to lift out the berries and examine them, asking Alice to refresh the water between each experiment on each pie. It became immediately apparent that three of the tarts were identical, containing only red berries, but two of the tarts contained a smattering of green berries among the red. I suspected right away that the green, unripened berries were the culprit. "Who made the filling?" "I did, sir," said Alice. She had a pained look of panic on her face that stirred me to pity. "I don't think you'll be held to account for this, Alice, as I believe it was an accident. You are from London, I hear."
"Yes, sir."
"Born and bred?" "Oh, yes, sir. Oxford is as far in the country as I've ever lived." It was a stretch to think of the bustling city as the country, but of course it was surrounded by country, and to someone from London it might seem a vast wilderness, dreaming spires and all. "From where did you get the berries?" At this, her anxiety increased exponentially. She opened her eyes wide and seemed almost to stop breathing. She looked to the cook for reassurance and found none, for Mary appeared as baffled as the principal. "They come from the covered market in town," she said. "Cook sent me to buy them for the pudding."
"They all came from the market?"
"Yes," she said.
"Mostly."
"Mostly," I repeated and waited. Lady Felicia had her dark eyes trained on Alice, who I thought might faint dead away under the scrutiny. "I done nothing wrong," said Alice, gathering the shreds of her remaining strength about her. "It were my day off, and I walked out beyond that park near the river to take some exercise to stretch me legs like. There was wild berries growing out there in the woods, and I used my initiative, like cook says I should. I thought we didn't have enough berries for all them tarts, and a few of the wild berries could be used as filler-like." She'd been out walking with a young man, no doubt. From the look on the principal's face, she was having the same thought, and it didn't please her. No whiff of scandal of that nature must touch the college, not ever. The poisoning might be the lesser of two evils in her view. "You see," Alice was saying, "they're making her talkative. The cook has been letting me do more of the cooking as time goes on. She's been training me up for something more."
"That is true," said Mary, looking as if she rued the day.
But what is it, sir? Whatever is the matter?" She turned to the principal. "I done nothing wrong, I swear it." She might have been referring to the tarts or to her dalliance with her young man, and my guess was her anxiety stemmed more from her involvement with the man than from the berries.
"Do you not see?" I asked.
"No, sir. See what, sir?"
"Alice, what color is my scarf?"
"Why, it's brown and white stripes, sir." My scarf was in fact green and white, the colors of St. James's College. I looked at her as she stood there, a riot of color, and at once I understood. I had a sudden recollection from my recent leisure reading of the life of John Greenleaf Whittier. He had been colorblind, a fact only discovered when he was asked to pick strawberries one day. He returned with a basket full of ripe red berries and unripe green ones. To him, of course, they looked the same. Color blindness, as I knew from my medical studies, was rare in females, but not unheard of. I was no botanist, but I was going to guess that mixed in with the assorted berries for the tarts,
were what in Massachusetts we called snake berries. Their scientific name is Solanum dulcamara. It is a variety of nightshade, not to be confused with deadly nightshade or Atropa belladonna, to which it is cousin. When ripe, it may cause slight discomfort to an adult, but when unripe, it is poisonous, especially to children. I considered it a godsend that no one had been taken more seriously ill, but the fact that the tarts were made of mixed fruit meant that the danger was diluted, as it were. The woman who had been taken quickly ill probably had the bad luck to be given a tart with several green berries in it, their color disguised by the dark filling and the darkness of a candlelit room. I explained all this to the women, who were dumbfounded, to say the least. My good deed for that day was in persuading the cook and Lady Felicia that Alice was innocent of any deliberate crime. Also that Alice must never again be put in charge of the pudding. They made me an honorary member of St. Helena's House for meritorious service. Of all my awards, it is the one of which I am most proud.
The Oxford Tarts is copyrighted by G.M. Mellier. Music for the podcast is by Paco Santiago and was obtained from the Community Audio section of the Internet Archive. Mixing for this podcast was done by Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one, by visiting our website at www.themysteryplace.com/EQMM.